Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
Now on view at Skadfesh, Manish Arora's Life is Beautiful. Renowned for dazzling designs in a rainbow of colors, Manish Arora has brought the talent and craftsmanship of India's rich sartorial history to the global forefront, earning international acclaim on runways across three continents. Designing in India since the 1990s, Arora's glittering garments celebrate extravagant expressions of self through varied materials, techniques, and silhouettes in a triumphant union of Western and Eastern aesthetics adapted to today's multicultural society with a touch of humor. Find out more at skadfesh.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for listening. Years ago, comedian Julia Scotti lived and performed as Rick Scotti, sharing stages with stars like Jerry Seinfeld and Chris Rock. Her return to the stage was part of an extraordinary journey, discovering herself as a trans woman, reuniting with her family, and battling a life-threatening illness. Her remarkable life, in all of its joy, pain, and humor, is featured in a new documentary, Funny That Way. Later this hour, we'll talk with Julia Scotti and director Susan Sandler. First, a lyrical tale of an ex-Civil War soldier in the Wyoming Territory. Indigo Heaven, the new book by Mark Warren, is a literary Western novel. There's a Southern aspect to it as well, two regions well understood by the author who lives in North Georgia. Mark Warren joins us now via Zoom. Welcome back to City Lights.
Thank you, Lois. It's so nice to be back with you.
The protagonist of this story is Clayton Jane, and we meet him as a young boy. What can you tell us about him?
Well, he's born into a very isolated world. His father, who is a Scottish immigrant, is basically his slave driver. His mother has been lost to disease, and Clayton is left with a father who is pretty much in a mission to go to battle against the world. He feels like he's victimized by the world, and he's struggling to bring about a successful farm in the mountains of North Georgia. And he has no one to help him but his very young son. Comes of age much too fast.
Yeah. In fact, his abusive father is so unbearable that young Clayton enlists in the army at the base of Lookout Mountain. We should add, this is set during the Civil War. Later, when his friends learn Clayt is an ex-Confederate soldier, he explains he didn't even know anything about a cause in the war, and he was damn sure he wasn't fighting to keep a man a slave. If I'd had a better grip on the whole story, he said, he's not sure he would have enlisted, much less which side he would have fought. Clayton James had no idea what the war was about, but what did this very young boy provide the Confederate Army?
I think there were probably a lot of people in his situation who got swept up in it, some of them out of peer pressure and some out of just lack of knowledge about what the war was about. But for Clayton, it was a exit out of something else. But because of his young age, he was able to infiltrate enemy territory as a very young spy, because he would be the last person to be suspected of such a role. So that's how his career in the war began. But because he was put in charge of taking care of the horses, it was soon evident that he had a special knack with horse care, and he was eventually taken in by one of the very famous generals of the war, Nathan Bedford Forrest, who, if listeners don't know, is the man who originated the Ku Klux Klan.
Evil man.
Later, of course. And Forrest was a cavalry leader, and Clayton became part of that, where one of those men who was inducted into that terrible, terrible group of people who have violence just completely acceptable in their lives. They just are immersed in it, and taking another person's life, as war will often do, becomes the norm. And that loss of appreciation for another man's life is a terrible loss to incur, which is one of the things that brings veterans back home from any war in such terrible shape in order to try to slip back into society.
Yeah. The chaos and madness of battle brings out such brutality in the young Clayton that he kills a drummer boy, not even a combat soldier. What is the consequence for Clayton after that gruesome death?
Well, it's the eye-opener for him. At that point, he rises up from a terrible incident of killing that young boy to at least a level of being able to recognize what he's done. And he's wounded at that point, seriously wounded. Perhaps in another book, that in itself would serve as balancing the scales of justice in what he's done. But he's a sensitive enough person to realize that he has some great debt to pay in the sense of the universe, that his sins are unredeemable, really. And as so many people did in that time after the war, he sought a whole new venue to hopefully just grasp a new life somehow. He had no idea how he's going to try to redeem himself, but it looked like destiny took a little hand there for him and wasn't going to let someone who was as good a man as Clay spend the rest of his life in the misery of the consequences of what he'd done.
Yeah. What did Clay think the West could offer?
I think just distance. He didn't know what he would find there, of course. In a way, it was much like my life when I was a boy. I grew up in College Park, just south of Atlanta. And I didn't even know about the mountains being in North Georgia. And when I finally just happened to be taken there as a young boy or through there, that was a life changer for me, because I knew that I wanted to come back there and spend the rest of my life there. For Clay, when he went out into the open spaces, for a long time, being in the prairie was just an aimless journey that seemed to have no end. But he hit mountains himself, and this was the main spine that runs down through America, the Rockies. And he really didn't know why, but he turned his course to go north and to follow these mountains to see what he might find. And there's something about the land there. The land took him in. If you've ever seen the Teton Mountains or gone a little farther into what exists in Wyoming, it's not hard to see how the visual effect can grab you. And so he ended up there at the Laramie Plain, which is bounded on the west side by the Medicine Bow Mountains. It just spoke to him, just like the mountain spoke to me when I was a boy.
Would you read paragraph 3, please, on page 21, beginning with the plains?
The plains seemed to go on forever. The gently rolling land seemed to mirror the endless sky. The vastness of it all gave him its first seed of hope. Here in this spacious country, where a man was constantly dwarfed by the grandeur of his surroundings, he might learn to burn up his past and let the sparks scatter to the stars. under this broad western sky, there seemed to be more directions, more possibilities, not just about what to do with his life, but also what kind of man to be. Mm.
He encounters a trapper who offers him food, and that trapper suggests that Clayt consider the Laramie Plain, where he'll get to see the medicine bows and, quote, the prettiest piece of land this side of heaven. The Wilderness School of Earth Lore that you founded is called Medicine Bow. Is that in honor of the Wyoming Mountain Range?
Well, the mountains and my name for my school are both honoring the same thing, which is an actual ceremonial bow that some of the Plains tribes use, never for killing, but only for ceremony. And that idea always appealed to me. There's a Medicine Bow River, a Medicine Bow National Forest, and the Medicine Bow Mountains, of course.
Early in his travels in Arkansas, Clayt meets a toothless weaver woman who offers him food and shelter for a few days, in return for which he plows her garden bed. What is the significance of her role in this story?
It's what she gives him as a parting gift. She's a very strange old woman and not someone that most people could connect to, but Clayt must have seen something in her that just opened his heart to her a little bit. And he was always one to be sure to balance the scales of debts. So she had given him something, and so he did some work for her. The reader gets a sense that this old woman has some kind of sense of prophecy, perhaps. And she gives him an old wool blanket that she has dyed in alder. Alder is a shrub-like tree that grows here, and it has a most remarkable bright orange inner bark. The first time I ever saw it was a chunk of wood sitting beside a river that I was canoeing, and it was so bright orange, I just was so curious about it. I wanted to know what it was. The beaver had provided me that first view of alder. And then later, as I began exploring into colors of the inner barks of trees, I found that alder was indeed the one. But this blanket, which at first just seems like a very simple gift, she told him that it would take care of him. And Clayt had no idea what that meant. One of my favorite parts about this story is how that blanket does eventually become his salvation.
Yes, it is a talisman. Eventually, Clayt wanders onto the Afton Ranch. How is he received by the first men he met?
He finds them to be very amicable, and he is a quiet, shy boy at that point still. They ask him if he's looking for work, and they have an opportunity for him there. So he starts out on the bottom rung of a cattle ranch, and he works his way up by merit, which is something that I truly cherish in life, when something happens on merit. And all of the good things in Clayt come out in that sense of working with the ranch, and he learns how to be with other men who can connect with him with strong bonds of friendship. But it's his ethic that eventually impresses all. It's an ethic of honor and directness and someone who can be depended on and trusted. And he works his way up to be Afton's right-hand man. So he is the foreman. And because the other men respect him so much, he is the excellent choice for this job because they will work for him.
It's at this point in the story where you mention the idea of redemption. Would you talk about redemption as an overarching theme in this story?
Well, all of us have things in our past that haunt us, and Clayt's probably is the worst that could be, which is the taking of the life of that young drummer boy. You know, I've heard people say to me, when you get to be an old person, you don't want to regret the things that you've never done. And I'm getting into that category. And I do not have that regret at all. And I find that there's a greater regret, and that is a regret of things that I have done and wish that I hadn't. These are things that a person would never be proud to admit. But to me, that sense of living to be a better person in order to balance those scales, I feel like that's something that Clayton and I have in common. And what better way is there to redeem yourself than how you treat your fellow person and also how you treat nature?
Georgia author Mark Warren, his new novel, Indigo Heaven, is a literary Western. We'll be back with more of our conversation in just a moment. You're listening to WABE Atlanta.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Support for WABE comes from 100 Miles, a nonprofit committed to preserving Georgia's 100-mile coast. Protecting this critical coastal ecosystem takes all of us. Watch the stories of the innovators and future leaders who help keep our coast flowing at OurGeorgiaCoast.org.
This is City Lights on WABE. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for listening. If you've just tuned in, I've been speaking with Georgia author Mark Warren. His new book, Indigo Heaven, is about an ex-Civil War soldier working as a cattle hand in the Wyoming Territory. Here, the author describes the owners of the ranch, the Aftons.
Well, Mr. Afton is from England. He comes from money. And obviously, because he's able to come to America and start a major cattle ranch, which leads him to be the leading cattle owner in the territory. And there's a little bit of similarity here to the Billy the Kid story, where Billy is offered a job by an English cattleman, too, whose name is Tunstall. And he plays a major part in that whole story. And there's a similarity here with Clay and Afton, because when Afton takes him over as his foreman, this really is the true beginning of Clayton's chance to make something of himself. And he's one of those rare men of any time, even including our time, who recognizes his happiest place in life. Clayton has no aspirations to go any higher or to do anything else. He recognizes that this is the time that I want to dominate my life right now. I believe that so many people get caught with that trap of climbing the ladder, especially in the workplace, and then one day look back and think, I was so happy when I was down there at that rung on the ladder. Why didn't I recognize that?
And how does Mr. Afton regard Clayton Jane?
With tremendous respect. Mr. Afton trusts Clayton to the extreme, and I think he finds him charming in a sense that Clay is uneducated and Afton is very educated, but he has so much trust in Clay's voice. He runs everything by Clay before he makes a final decision on it, because he knows that Clay really is the voice of reason, and also that ethic again. He probably admires that.
Perhaps the most endearing character is Chalky Sullins. What is his relationship with Clayton?
Chalky would be Clayton's mentor. Chalky is a black man. At the ranch, I would say he holds the position of being the most knowledgeable cowhand and ranch staff member who knows how to get all things done. He's the ultimate resource. He's the ultimate reference book on how do we get this problem solved. Chalky has been around. He's a powerful presence in the book because his knowledge of just survival skills on a ranch surpass everyone else's. And so Chalky recognizes in Clay an exemplary young man and takes him under his wing and teaches him everything. They grow to be peers, and they're very much like brothers.
That's interesting to hear you say they're like brothers, because I thought of Chalky as a father figure for Clay.
He was that too. I had a very similar experience in my life that I didn't have a father-son relationship with my father. And my first time after leaving home was working for a man who taught me a great deal about a lot of different things at a summer camp where I worked year round. And in the beginning, I thought of him as my father figure too. I recognized that. But the more that we worked together, the more we became brothers. And I've experienced that on the other end too, as a camp director myself, besides my adult classes that I lead, I once led summer camps for quite a long time. And I've had many, many young people come through my school and my camp. And as they've grown older, they went from that same status of the son figure to the peer figure, becoming brothers with me. So I've got very close friends now who were once children under my tutelage. Mm-hmm.
One takeaway from Indigo Heaven is that you learn a lot about someone by the way they treat a horse. Would you talk about how Clay teaches the little boy, Tom, to get acquainted with a horse?
Well, I would say that the main teaching tool is empathy. Clay teaches the boy that horses are individuals too, and that they have reactions and feelings, and you've got to approach a relationship with a horse that way. You've got to understand that the horse also has preferences and maybe in some cases demands about how things work.
And what is the, is it a ritual or a way of engaging that you blow warm air?
That's an old Indian practice. You know, the native people of the plains are perhaps the most famous of all American horsemen. And among those, if you wanted to single one tribe out, it might be the Comanche. They had a relationship with their horses that was extremely close, and it was commonly practiced among them to breathe into the horse's nostrils and to even sleep with the horses. And as you rubbed them down, you spoke to them. It was just such a close grooming of two partners. And that's what they were, really partners, rather than beast and master.
Yeah, that's definitely what we see in Clay with Skitter. There's a lot of excitement at the Afton Ranch about two visits. The first will be from Mr. Afton's sister and her family, and later a trip planned to Wyoming by the president, Ulysses Grant. What does the family visit add to the plot line?
The visitors from England are Mr. Afton's sister and her husband, which would be Afton's brother-in-law, and the son of that union. When they arrive, the woman turns out to be an impressive and very talented painter. And she's a painter who can paint the photographic, but has chosen not to, and to use suggestion, what we might think of in the Impressionist period. And it's a very tantalizing skill that she has, because it's almost like she can see things in the landscape that the average man can't see until it's pointed out to them. And there is a recognition in her and in Clay that each to the other is someone who deserves some attention. She recognizes the value of Clay's ethic, and he recognizes her talent and her relationship with land that runs through that talent, and both admire the other. And it leads to what could be, easily could be, a love affair, but it does not. They won't allow it to. But the bond between them is as strong as two people who are in love with one another. It turns out that she is the victim of abuse from her husband. And so that creates an inner turmoil within the Afton family. So now we have a triangle, even though it's not your typical triangle where a love has been declared, the triangle exists nevertheless. And the woman, the painter woman's husband, turns out to be an antagonist of Clay's. And I don't want to do any spoilers here, but creates quite a problem for Clay.
Even before he has met her, Clay is drawn to the paintings which hang in the Afton's home, those that were created by Isabella. And Clay's response to the paintings reveal his appreciation of the extreme dark and light in each composition. It's a window for readers into Clay's perception, and it provides readers some of your more lyrical writing as well. Would you read the bottom of page 91, the bottom paragraph, through the top of page 92?
The twilight coaxed from the prairie grass a faint blue. It was not something you could point your finger at, but a glow that seemed to leach into the night air like the seepage of a subtle fluorescent gas. He had seen it many times, but now he wondered how an artist might capture that blue-tinged air that hung over the land at early evening. Chalky called it God's last breath, blowing out the candle flame of the sky, just as daybreak allowed Clay his rightful ownership of the coming day. This parting color was like an elegiac entry in a ledger that recorded what a man had accomplished on that given day. That was what mattered, Clay knew, what you did and how you had done it. It was important because it was something larger than any one man. The thread of small deeds performed by each sorry damn cowboy stitched together to make the fabric of a working ranch. It was that fabric, Clay knew, that defined who he was.
The dark side of this story in the later part of the book deals with Isabella's husband, whom you've already said is physically abusive. He's unscrupulous in business and very pompous. What ensues from his actions?
He has come to take over the ranch. No one in the story is aware of the fact that Afton himself has created a situation where his debts have become overpowering, and his brother-in-law has bailed him out of this in England. And the results of that are that he is going to take over the ranch. And the conflict is, can these cowboys accept him as their leader, owner, employer, because they had a true devotion to Mr. Afton. They understood his limitations and that he didn't understand their lives, but they did have a respect for him because he treated them well. But now with this new owner, that's a very different story because he doesn't know how to treat men. He's more inclined to be wrapped up in his own power and, as you said, his pompous nature.
The plot becomes suspenseful at this point, and there are major developments that would spoil the excitement for future readers. But one beautiful aspect I think we can discuss is the grace we see from the Indians in this story. Would you elaborate?
Yeah, I have a tremendous interest in Native Americans and have studied their history of that time quite a bit. And so I wanted to be sure to introduce them as an example of humanity as they were. It's important because in that time, the Native Americans were really seen only as obstacles to manifest destiny. Manifest destiny, to my mind, is just one of the biggest examples of the human being rationalizing what he does. The great victim of all that were the people who had originally lived here, who had no sense of ownership about the land. So there are constantly conflicts that pop up between the white man and the red man throughout the West in that time. And so that's included in this story. But then Quate performs an act of charity with some starving Native Americans by allowing them to take a wounded cow to use as food. And none of his ranch hands understand what he's done. They almost feel betrayed by what he does. But it comes back to Quate in the way of a return favor. Quate finds himself in dire circumstances where he could literally die, but he's taken in by a tribe who are living in a remote area of the mountains. They're living as fugitives, really, because if they're found by the whites, they'll be exterminated because they're considered renegades. They're those who have not complied with reservation life. And it's a beautiful part of the book, in my opinion, this communication going on between people who do not speak the same language, but they know of Quate. And here's where that orange blanket comes in. They know of his past deeds with the Native people because he carries his odd colored blanket. And he has no idea about all this. He's at their mercy. He's helpless because of the physical situation that he's in. Again, I don't want to give all that away. But the conversations that go on between the two, as they each speak their own language and one does not understand the other, Quate does eventually understand that they are helping him. And he learns why later.
In the end, has Clayton Jane found redemption?
I think that anyone who reads the book would immediately say yes. If you ask Quate if he had, I don't think so. I think that he probably had done everything that was possible in his lifespan to find that redemption. But probably Quate would say something like, I'm still working on that.
Georgia author Mark Warren. His new novel is Indigo Heaven. Warren will be at Eagle Eye Bookshop for his book launch party tomorrow from 2 to 3 p.m. And you can learn more on our website, wabe.org/citylights. Up next, we'll talk with the star and the director of Julia Scotti. Funny that way. You're listening to WABE Atlanta. This is City Lights on WABE. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for listening. Beginning in the 1980s, comedian Julia Scotti performed as Rick Scotti and appeared on bills with the likes of Jerry Seinfeld and Chris Rock. Now, the trans comedian has returned to the stage as an older woman in comedy. Susan Sandler's new film, Julia Scotti, Funny That Way, tracks the comedian's true, tender, and very funny comeback story. Julia Scotti and Susan Sandler are with us now via Zoom. Welcome to City Life.
Thank you, Lois. Lovely to be here.
Great to be here, Lois. Thank you for having us.
This film was shot over a period of 5 years with the goal of telling Julia's life story. Susan, why did you think that Julia's story was worthy of that commitment?
Well, the journey of an indie doc is passion. You know, there's not a commissioned piece. This is not a production company standing around waiting for the film to be delivered. This was me by myself meeting Julia and feeling absolutely compelled to tell her story. And the compulsion was I was fascinated by her as a performer, as an individual, as someone who had a very important story to tell. And the commitment on her end, which I'm so grateful for, was that access. We didn't know what the journey was going to be, of course, because that's what documentary storytelling is. It's a wonderful attraction to a subject that is absolutely compelling, but without a story map. The story map is what life gives us, which unfolds with great surprises, as Julia gave us. So the journey was not meant to be 5 years. It's just what it happened to be as the storytelling unfolded. And I'm very, very grateful that Julia went on the ride with me.
Funny That Way is a roller coaster. It's hilarious. And there are also moments that are very painful, very raw, especially those that explain Julia's previous distance with her children. Julia, was it difficult for you to be that vulnerable on camera?
Yes and no. I mean, it was such a joyous part of my life having them come back into my life that I was grateful in a way to have it on record, you know, to be able to watch it and see it and share it with people too, whose stories may be similar to mine, who have lost somebody that they love in their life or more than somebody, and then to have them come back. So I wanted people to share the joy of having them come back, you know, and on the other hand, it was a private moment too, but I think the lesson taken from it was more important, that there is hope.
Oh, yeah. In fact, one of the comments you made in the film that really bowled me over was, self-loathing murderer of my former self. That just landed like a gut punch. Was it a shrink who said that to you?
No. It was in my journal. I kept pretty meticulous journals from about 1975, I guess, on. And I guess Susan, she combed through them page by page, right, Susan, wasn't that?
Oh, yeah. Julia gave me boxes and boxes of every piece of writing and photographs and videos, and so generously just opened it all up for me. And out of that, I pulled pieces that I thought would be valuable to the storytelling.
I love the use of animation throughout the film. Susan, would you talk about why you chose to include those segments?
Thank you. First, I want to give a shout out to our animator, the very gifted Sam Roth. And the process of working on the animation was to understand, you know, Julia's world is the world of comedy, the tone of the film, the storytelling, lifting it into that space with as many occasions as possible. First, we created, working with Sam, we created the essence of Julia as the cartoon figure that we meet at the top of the film in the prologue, and then I looked for sections of the storytelling that felt that they could be illuminated through animation in a way that would be both entertaining and tonally connected to the storytelling of the film. So it was a really exciting process to figure out which sections wanted to be animated, and then to work with a very gifted animator, Sam Roth, to realize that, and then to show it to Julia, to let her meet her animated self. So all those pieces.
Julia, what were your reactions when you saw those animated figures?
It was a surprise. I had known that Susan had gotten Sam to work on it, but to see, well, what are they going to do with the way I look? And it was a pretty accurate representation, I thought.
It was wonderful, and it was tender, I thought. It wasn't caricature-like in a negative way.
No, not at all. Not at all.
And when you put them in, Susan, it just felt so organic.
Yeah, it's, you know, the goal in all of the pieces of the storytelling, you know, I spent the 5 years of working on this film both combing through all of the archival material, which Julia shared with me, and much of which I had restored because, you know, a lot of VHS tapes don't store well and the material becomes disintegrated, so a lot of capturing of that material and converting it and then combing through it to find where the jewels were that we were going to use, and then figuring out, of course, the story structure. And that's the whole, you know, journey in the storytelling piece, the writing of a documentary. Life is, you know, life is life, and we're telling the truth. But, you know, people's lives are complex, and Julia is a complex character with a fascinating life. So figuring out what the spine of the story is, and then, you know, which paintbrush to pick up at what point in the storytelling, an archival image or interview images, or in this case, figuring out where the animation would illuminate part of the story. So, you know, that process, and of course, the animation that Sam did is not something that happens overnight. Each of those sequences took a long time. They're all hand-drawn. So it was really exciting to figure those pieces out and then to work collaboratively with him on that. And I'm very glad that you feel that it blends seamlessly. That's the goal.
Absolutely. Julia, it was beautiful to witness your reconnection with your kids, and delightful to find out that both your kids are comedy fans. Your son, Dan, is even a comedy writer and has done some stand-up himself. How did it make you feel to discover that your kids had this love of comedy despite the years you were distanced from them?
I was more surprised by my daughter's interest in it than my son. My son was always a ham, and when I found out that he was doing it, I was like, yeah, no big surprise there. loves comedy, and he's loved it since he was a little one. But my daughter, she always struck me as being serious, you know, I completely lost touch with them all those years. So I had no idea that she had this growing interest. So it was, for her, a surprise. For my son, no, not at all.
The fact that you were married a few times is essential to your story. And in hindsight, you say that you think most people should wait till they are older to get married. Why is that true?
I do think people should be sure about marriage. Is, you know, it's not like the 1800s where we lived to be 30 and then die. You know, you can get married at, 20 and then be the widow by 30, you know, you're going to be with somebody 40, 50, 60 years. You better be damn sure that you like this person. Especially, you know, for me and for a lot of trans people, multiple marriages are pretty common, you know, that we're all trying to find that normal in our lives. And so what's more normal than a white picket fence and 2.3 kids? I just think I have my own personal feelings about marriage in general, but yeah, I think you should wait.
Kate is particularly important to your story. Would you talk a little bit about her?
Kate is the most remarkable human being I've ever known in my life. She's the love of my life. I still love her and probably will till the day I die. She also is the person who selflessly and lovingly helped me discover that I was trans when I didn't know what the issue was.
And she was your wife.
We're married, yes. But the marriage was annulled. So I call it I was married 2.5 times. She's my half time.
There is a very rough moment in the film when Julia's watching one of her decades-old performances and appalled to realize that she's done a bit that made fun of trans people. Susan, why did you want to include that in the documentary?
There was an opportunity to comb through the archival material and let Julia see what we found. It was an archival dig, and I knew that that was going to be revelatory and dramatic and a kind of important marker. It was very interesting that opportunity was in sync with Dan's visit, so that Julia was able to discover that material with him and talk about it with him. And I think that marker is very significant in terms of the then and now of her story. Hmm.
Julia, in your time off from comedy, you became a teacher. What attracted you to teaching?
First of all, I love kids. So teaching and comedy are very similar.
How so?
Well, you have a captive audience, you know, in the kids, and you have a captive audience in a nightclub. The only difference is hopefully that the kids aren't drunk and the audience is. You know, but they, it was a natural for, you know, for me, because teaching answers a lot of my needs, and because I get bored on a job really easy, but the kids will keep you. No 2 days are the same in a classroom. There's always some, you know, multiple crises to deal with. And, you know, I get to use all of my creative juices that keeps them flowing too. So it was a natural progression. And a lot of comedians I know either came from teaching into comedy, or went from, when they left comedy, went into teaching. So
really?
Yeah. We make great teachers, comedians.
Well, when you went back to teaching, what age group were your students?
Sixth grade teacher, yeah.
And do any of those students keep in touch or watch your comedy?
Yeah, I have a couple of them that stay in touch with me. A few of them have come to the shows, and I didn't recognize them because they're all grown up now, and it makes me cry because I'm so old. But so it makes me laugh, you know, to see how wonderfully they you know, turned out.
Let's talk about your time on America's Got Talent. Julia, what was it like for you to perform to an audience of that size and scale?
I had really thought this through before I actually walked out on the stage, and I had worked theaters before where there were several thousand people, so I was used to that. It didn't bother me. It was a little different having the four judges in front of me. That was kind of intimidating. But my plan was to just look beyond them and not really pay attention to whether they were laughing or not. Although, peripherally, I could see Simon out of the corner of my eye. And when he did laugh, I went, okay, I got this.
Talk about a testament.
Well, yeah, huh? Well, you don't think about the 13 million other people that are watching at home, because it's irrelevant. They don't exist, you know, when you're in that moment.
True. On the other hand, you have someone in the moment who could be rather intimidating, to put it mildly.
Yeah. But I knew that Howie, you know, I knew that I had enough confidence in my ability as a comic to know that Howie would get what I was doing. And I knew that if nobody else on that panel liked me, Howie would, you know, jump to my defense, which he did. But Simon, when I saw him laugh, you could see it was genuine. You know, I just put my foot to the gas and just didn't look back, because I knew it was a done deal. It was going to be okay.
Julia's health becomes an issue toward the end of the time filming, and there's a hospital room recovery scene in the film. Yeah, talk about not funny and vulnerability. Susan, would you tell us what determined your choice to include that part of Julia's story?
Well, first, you know, it was so incredibly courageous of Julia to allow the camera into her life at that moment. And I'm very grateful for that. And I think what we see in the arc of the storytelling is someone with, Julia was, I think, 2 weeks away at that point from taping a Showtime comedy special. This was, you know, the timing on that event was unbelievably shocking for her. And what we see in her story and in her life and in her example is extraordinary resilience. And that's why that sequence is important. And that's why the movement of the story around her recovery and the choices that she's making to live such a healthy life. This is a person, this is a woman with great strength and great will and a bionic determination, right? So, you know, she keeps on keeping on and keeps us very connected to what matters in life.
Of course, you mine your life-threatening illness for comedy material, Julia, when you talk about your quadruple bypass and say your arteries were clogged with pastry and cheeseburgers. Could have been a great animation, Susan. You could have had a wonderful little cartoon. Truly an event. I'm so glad you've recovered, your health has recovered, and now that you are well again, Julia, what's next?
Wow. Well, I'm working now putting together material for a new album that I'm recording November the 6th of this year, if all goes well. So there's that. I wrote a play.
Yeah, beautiful play.
Uh-huh. We're hoping to get that maybe produced.
Wow. Will you act in it?
No. No. I'm too close to it, first of all, and I'm too old for it, for the parts, anyway.
Do you have anyone in mind whom you'd love to see perform you?
The character's actually not me.
Oh.
They're based on people I know. They're composite characters, so.
Oh, now you do have me intrigued. I thought it was exquisite when you said, if it's your truth, it's going to be hard to talk about. Julia Scotti, thank you for talking about your truth so beautifully and so hilariously.
I live by the words of Charlie Chaplin, who said, to truly laugh, you must be able to take your pain and play with it. And that's what I've tried to do.
Comedian Julia Scotti and filmmaker Susan Sandler. Sandler's new documentary, Julia Scotti, Funny That Way, is streaming on iTunes, Amazon Prime, Google Play, DirecTV, and more. You can learn more about the film on our website, wabe.org/citylights. You've been listening to City Lights, our daily exploration of arts and culture. Catch an encore broadcast tonight at 9. Monday at 11 a.m., I'll talk with pianist Laura Downs, the host of NPR Music's Amplify with Laura Downs. Her new album, New Day Begun, features music by 15 Black composers spanning more than a century. Our theme music is The First Time, written and performed by Joe Grandston with his jazz band. Special thanks to Hot Shoe Records. City Lights senior producer is Kim Drobes. Summer Evans is our producer, and our engineer is Shelley Canavy. I'm your host, Lois Reitzes. I would love it if you'd follow me on Twitter at LOISREITZES. You can also follow us on Facebook at WABE City Lights. Archived interviews and shows are on our website, wabe.org/citylights. Wishing you a safe and good weekend, and thanks for listening to WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of mysteries. Are ghosts real? Is that yogurt expired? Hey, the unknown can be scary, but when you donate to WABE, you know where your money is going. Your gift supports the journalism that keeps you informed and the programs that pull back the curtain on complicated stories. Help us make the world less mysterious. Become a member now. Go online to wabe.org/donate, and thanks.